Officials in the U.S. had no idea whether or not the interceptions were even working.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, these interceptions were being aided by three nuclear-powered nations, the U.S., the U.K., and France, plus the Arab Protective Arm of Israel, the Jordanian government.
So much for the invisibility of Zionist Israel.
All about both the strikes and what the U.S. knows about Israel's plan for a response. What do you know? What did you find out?
Well, let's go through some of this, Alex, and I'm just going through my notes because this call just ended and it was just about, I guess, almost 45 minutes that we were on with these senior officials going through it. First of all, they said it was a very significant attack and that at one point in the Situation Room last night, there were more than 100 ballistic missiles in the air, and the president and his national security team did not know whether they had landed, whether they had been intercepted, because they were only minutes away coming from Iran towards Israel. Separately, I was talking to a senior administration official earlier this afternoon, who told me that all of the missiles and the drones and the UAVs that came from Iran were heading towards a military base, towards one military base in Israel. None went towards any civilian areas. There were other projectiles that did come from other areas, from Hezbollah, for instance, and from other Iranian proxies. But what was so unprecedented about this, of course, was that it was a very large, significant attack, an attack that the officials said intended to create significant damage.
So as you heard, Marwa, the initial MSNBC report just a few hours after the retaliation was according to U.S. officials in the White House and in the Department of Defense.
Mm-hmm.
And they both affirmed that this was a very large, significant, and unprecedented attack, and that they had no viable information on whether or not the interceptive projectiles,
mm-hmm.
which, by the way, were worth $1 billion,
yeah.
Had actually worked or not. So MSNBC wanted us to believe that the Israeli narrative that 99% were shot down, which even an Israeli analyst said was false.
Mm-hmm.
Let's listen to this.
Okay.
When both the Situation Room and the work cabinet had been through these moments when they did not know if Israel's defenses and the combined Allied defenses were going to work because the ballistic missiles moved so quickly,
mm-hmm.
in contrast to the UAVs and some of the cruises. But those missiles moved so quickly, they didn't know whether they were going to strike. And in fact, what they've now discovered is that 99% were thwarted. They were thwarted, 4 to 6, they said, were thwarted by the Arleigh Burke and the USS Kearney, the two destroyers in the area, the U.S. destroyers. Others were taken down by fighter jet pilots, British and Americans, who were in the air. And then the majority of those ballistic missiles were taken down by the Arrow defenses, the air defenses of Israel.
Where do we start? It's like these people don't have calculators on their smartphones. I mean, 99% means that only 3 missiles landed, whereas Israel said itself that 15 missiles had made it through,
mm-hmm.
at least 15,
mm-hmm.
Which would mean that 5% made it through. And there were only 300 missiles. Let's remember that. Iran fires 120% more than that during regular IRGC military drills.
Mm-hmm.
In any case, even an Israeli military analyst recently told the Hebrew newspaper Ma'ariv that the 99% percent number is completely wrong, and
mm-hmm.
the real number is more like 84%.
Mm-hmm.
And we can't forget that that's with all the help of U.S. defenses and Patriot missiles and expensive toys, basically, that Israel gets from its friends.
Definitely.
Now, later on during the week, MSNBC kept on emphasizing the Biden administration's demand that Israel not respond to the Iranian operation,
mm-hmm.
and consider the April 14 attack a win for the Zionists.
Top U.S. officials are worried that a potential Israeli response could provoke a wider regional war that the U.S. could be dragged into.
Joining us now is NBC's Richard Engel from Jerusalem, and also with us is retired four-star general Barry McCaffrey, an NBC News military analyst. Richard, fill us in on the latest from this Israeli war cabinet meeting.
So this is a fast-moving story. As of this morning, it seemed like the U.S. was getting what it wanted, that it had succeeded in convincing Prime Minister Netanyahu, with a call from President Biden directly to Netanyahu, not to respond, to take what happened over the weekend, quote, as a win. The fact that Iran fired hundreds of drones and missiles and that nearly all of them failed or were shot down caused almost no damage in this country.
But how did Israel respond to these U.S. requests? I think the British outlet Channel 4's reporting about it was quite interesting.
Thanks for the advice and support, but Israel will make its own decisions. That was the message from Benjamin Netanyahu to his British and German visitors who came here to Jerusalem today. Now, they are now at a G7 meeting of foreign ministers in Italy, pushing for coordinated sanctions against Iran. But their calls for restraint do not appear to have stretched to Gaza, where the killing goes on unabated, or to the West Bank, where tensions have also been escalating. Here's our foreign affairs.
So basically, Israel cried and ran to the protection of the US, UK and France
again,
as the attack on its colonial military base was taking place, mm-hmm. but brushed off and ignored all requests to restrain itself and not retaliate against Iran. Because as Netanyahu said, Israel will make its own decisions. Mm-hmm. And Israel did retaliate, but it was so weak that you can't even consider it a response.
I mean, it's very funny, Fuad, considering that they run crying to the West, please help protect us. And then when the West says, just sit tight, stop causing any trouble, they say, no, we have every right to do so. It is honestly
genocidal behavior.
Definitely, definitely. Well, thank you very much,
thank
Fuad,
for
your analysis. Now, ladies and gents, we will move on to digital mainstream media. Since the beginning of the Israeli entity genocidal war on Gaza, support among Western nations for this blatant military assault has been nearly limitless. That might not be so shocking, but what is shocking is the neglect of their media's own supposedly sacred values when those who fund and control these Western media outlets believe that the actual narrative does not advance their own interests. Here is our digital media expert Julia Qasim with the latest on blatant Western media censorship in favor of Zionist Israel.
Thank you, Marwa. So several American digital and print media outlets are now facing this backlash from their own staff over clear editorial policies that have led to essentially a repetition of Israeli propaganda and the censoring of Palestinian perspectives in their coverage of the genocidal war on Gaza. Mm-hmm. So beginning with the scandalous expose about the New York Times, which instructed journalists covering Israel's war on Gaza to restrict the use of the terms genocide and ethnic cleansing and to avoid using the phrase occupied territory when describing Palestinian land. That is, Marwa, according to a copy of the internal memo leaked by the New York Times and obtained by The Intercept. So in a piece published by them on April 15th titled Leaked New York Times Gaza Memo Tells Journalists to Avoid Words Genocide, Ethnic Cleansing, and Occupied Territory, written by Jeremy Scahill, Ryan Grimm, The Intercept found that the memo, written by Times Standard editor Susan Wessling, international editor Philip Pan, and their deputies, offers guidance about some terms and other issues we have grappled with since the start of the conflict in October. Mm-hmm. So, Marwa, while the document was presented as an outline in maintaining objective journalistic principles in reporting on Gaza, several New York Times staffers told The Intercept that some of its contexts show evidence of the paper's deference to Israeli narratives. Mm-hmm. So you see, issuing guidance like this to quote-unquote ensure accuracy, consistency, and nuance is how the New York Times staff should cover the news about Israel's genocide in Gaza. It's considered standard practice by the likes of New York Times, but the same guideline essentially becomes non-existent when it comes to reporting, say, the Iranian retaliatory attack on Israel, which exposes the double standards that are completely hypocritical of Western media.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting to see the New York Times try to hide from this scandal when printing an opinion piece by Jody Ginsburg, who is also the chief executive of the Committee to Protect Journalists, mm-hmm. entitled The Israeli Censorship Regime is Growing, That Needs to Stop. Mm-hmm. So when someone goes over this opinion piece, you'd think that the New York Times is actually, you know, doing something good and insightful in highlighting the Israeli censorship of their military's ongoing genocide of Palestinians. But, of course, there's no coincidences here. Mm-hmm. This was just published one day after The Intercept's leaks about the New York Times memo, its obvious damage control, and it's reminiscent of calls by liberal media like Christina Manpour from CNN, making the tone-deaf claim a week and a half ago that there are no journalists on the ground in Gaza, mm-hmm. Despite the extensive coverage of Palestinian reporters, freelancers, and citizen journalists on the ground documenting anything, everything. Mm-hmm. So in this New York Times opinion piece, Jody Ginsburg states that the refusal to allow international media to cover Gaza from the life inside is just one element of a growing censorship regime that leaves a vacuum for propaganda, mis- and disinformation, and claims and counterclaims that there are extraordinarily difficult to verify independently. Mm-hmm. So she continues to criticize Israel, claiming that the occupation entity champions itself as a democracy and a bastion of free press in the region. But its actions, of course, tell a different story. And at the same time, it's evident a piece like this could run because it's repeating the same rhetoric of there being a vacuum open for propaganda while kind of glossing over the mm-hmm. presence of Palestinian journalists on the ground, essentially.
For sure.
But to her credit, she does criticize the actions of the Zionist entity's allies, too. She writes that Israel's allies, too, pride themselves on their commitment to a free press. The U.S., Britain, and other Israeli allies like Germany all loudly proclaim their commitment to a pluralistic and independent media. But their governments explicitly support news outlets that broadcast information into and about countries that censor and control information, such as Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, which is funded by the U.S. Congress. So it's evident also in the U.S. Secretary of State, Anthony Blinken's visit to Doha, Marwa, on October 13th, the first week of Israel's genocide in Gaza, mm-hmm. where he explicitly asked the Qatari Prime Minister, Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdul Rahman Al Thani, to turn down the volume on Al Jazeera's Gaza coverage. Mm-hmm. Put this in contrast to Hillary Clinton, who praised Al Jazeera's coverage in the onset of the...
When it's good for them. When it actually gives them credit for something that they want to see in their interest.
That they engineered.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah,
exactly. So according to Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, in an investigative report published on January 11, 2024, Hamdullah Baykar, entitled Blinken's Request to Censor Al Jazeera Against All American Values, this was definitely not the first time the U.S. government officially asked Qatar to censor Al Jazeera because mm-hmm. it's reporting a narrative against U.S. interests in the Middle East. So according to Carnegie, this blatant U.S. request for censorship is not an individual case when it comes to Al Jazeera and their coverage of the Middle East and wider Muslim world. So following the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003, the administration of former President George W. Bush allegedly pressured Qatar to close down, privatize, or censor the channel.
Wow.
So this proves that there is a precedent, Marwa, and while the Biden administration has not used explicit military force against the channels reporting on the genocide in Gaza, they have turned a blind eye and enabled the Zionist entities' killing of journalists and their families in Palestine. Not only in Gaza, but also in Lebanon.
Mm-hmm. And provide them with the weapons to do so, actually.
Unconditionally.
Exactly. And then turning a blind eye to when the world says that this is a war crime and they do nothing about it. Anyways, thank you very much, Ms. Julia Qasim, for telling us about this expose and the scandals that come out of the Western print and digital mainstream media. Thank you very much for your time
and
contribution.
You.
Ladies and gents, stay tuned because next we have social media expose. As expected, the Iranian strike on Zionist Israel, dubbed True Promise Operation, is still reverberating on social media platforms amongst both supporters and opposers of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Here's our own Sima Itayim, social media expert, with the latest.
Thank you for having me, Marwa. It's
pleasure.
Been surreal. So social media users in Iran, particularly those who support the axis of resistance, of course, mocked the attack as a measly response to the roughly 300 missiles and drones mm-hmm. that Iran launched at Israel last weekend. Then we move on to Hadi Nasrallah, who took mm-hmm. it home, as usual, with his on-point posts.
As usual.
Saying Israel went from beating seven armies in 6 days to sending paper drones and nagging online about being bullied, LMFAO. Safe to say Israel has been deterred.
Yeah, safe to say that.
Now we move on to some exposés by those who are still hinged on the unprecedented Operation True Promise, which mm-hmm. shook the Israeli regime to its core for the first time in a long time.
Mm-hmm.
So we begin with Harun Kimani, who posted, Iranian Sejil ballistic missiles and Sumar cruise missiles have taken out all Israeli F-35 fighter jets when mm-hmm. they hit the Nevatim Air Force Base. Number one, each F-35 costs $136 million, and they were 36, meaning $4.9 billion loss in one night. Number two, Israeli government has acknowledged that Iran targeted military sites only. Civilian sites were not targeted. Number three, the much-touted Iron Dome was blind to the incoming Iranian missiles. Number four, the Sejil missile is so fast that it can travel from IR to IL in less than 10 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Next, we have a post by Saeed who mocked Israel's response by posting, time it took them to release satellite images from Iran, 12 hours. Time it took them to release satellite images from Israeli terrorists, 5 days and still pending. If you have a brain bigger than a hamster, you know exactly what's going on here. Shabbat Shalom, Israel. Mm-hmm. And then the cherry on top, of course, was posted by many accounts, including Mint Press. Here we have Mint Press's post, who posted the video by Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian in New York when asked about the operation, the response.
Foreign Minister, any comments on last night's strike? Will Iran retaliate?
What strike?
So Mint Press captioned the video, Iran mocks Israel. Mm-hmm. It was quite a classic moment. And, you know, he was asked while in New York if there would be a response to Israel's attack, to which he replied, what strike? Mm-hmm. And the minister's assistant sarcastically replied to that.
Mm-hmm. So basically, it was a week where people were mocking the Israeli entity's strike and then recapping what happened on April 14. I mean, Twitter, in specific, X platform, X is an amazing place to be when you're at the like a cliff of a World War III. It's a bit entertaining. Thanks, Aminian, for being with us.
Thank you.
Seema, to tell us about it. Now, ladies and gents, stay tuned because next we'll be talking about figures expose. A recent survey by the Hebrew University of Jerusalem found that 52% of Israeli occupation settlers were opposed to a retaliation against the Islamic Republic of Iran for fear that it will further fuel the cycle of regional tensions. Now, the Hebrew University survey was conducted between April 14 and 15 by internet and telephone and sampled 1,466 men and women representing adult Israeli entity settlers. Now, the Israeli entity public's opposition rose to 74% if this counteroffensive were to jeopardize security alliances of the Israeli entity's allies. Hence, the mini quadcopters stroke. When asked if Zionist Israel should launch an attack against the Islamic Republic of Iran, 52% opposed the attack, while 48% approved of it. Asked further about the response Zionist Israel should take, a quarter of the 48% of who supported a counterattack said it should take place on Iranian soil, with 88% disapproving and 12% approving. And only 1 in 3 were in favor of a strike against strategic nuclear sites, with 67% disapproval rate and 33% approve. Also questioned on their perception of Zionist Israel's strength against Iran, 46% of respondents said that Zionist Israel is strong, compared to 27% who thought it is weak, and another 27% estimated it to be neither strong nor weak, making it a swooping 54% who have lost all faith in the invincibility of their own occupation army. Now, let us move on to the most notable expose voices for this week. Now, TikTok went wild last week as the United States of America vetoed a draft resolution at the UN Security Council which recommended granting the state of Palestine full membership in the United Nations. The veto by Zionist Israel's main political and military backer had been expected ahead of the vote. However, it did bring Palestine ambassador to the UN Riyad Mansour to an emotional speech. Here's Mansour's voice by Viary Video.
We will not disappear. We love life, to live in freedom and dignity in our national homeland.
Now, our aggravated voice for this week was by Eric Warsaw, who said that acts like this undermines the United Nations as an assembly and makes the U.S. come off as just plain ridiculous.
So this is breaking news right now. The United States just used its superpower veto to not allow Palestine membership into the United Nations. That is absolutely ridiculous. Everybody has the right to sit at the United Nations, to speak, have a voice, and vote in everything. This is an abuse of the superpower veto. This is completely unnecessary. Every group of people has a right at the United Nations to speak and be heard, everybody. And really, it's of no interest for America to be even doing this. It doesn't benefit us. It doesn't hurt us. We should be completely neutral to this topic. We're only doing it because for AIPAC, for Israel. And that's what makes it even more ridiculous. Acts like this undermine the United Nations as an assembly and as an effective group. It makes the United Nations less effective, and it also makes America look bad.
Now, ladies and gents, with that, we conclude our expose for tonight. Stay tuned for more eye-opening investigations on Expose. The truth is just a revelation away.
This is Back to Reality. Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRB English Radio. Welcome back to a new episode of your very favorite Back to Reality. This is Asma. Once more, I have the honor to be your host. And then here with me, I have two very dear guests, Sister Rehana and Sister Nahid. Assalamu alaikum, both of you.
Assalamu alaikum. Assalam.
We have a ritual in this program in which you have to introduce yourself briefly for those audience who do not know you. But we just have to hear a little bit of introduction about yourself, briefly.
Well, yeah. First of all, I'm really honored to be with you and your dear listeners. My name is Nahid. I'm a TFL graduate, and it's been a while that I'm conducting some various researches on Muslim, especially Muslim women.
Thank you very much. And you, Sister Rehana?
I'm Rehana, and currently I'm proud to say that I'm a stay-at-home mother, and this is what I spend my time in right now. And I'm very interested in Islamic topics regarding the well-being of Muslim women, especially.
Thank you very much for being here, both of you. It's a pleasure to be there with you. And let's get back to reality. Well, we've always heard that truth is everything. When you say the truth, that's self-sufficient, and in itself, it's a virtue. But is it really? Do we find everything in truth?
This topic really reminded me of a story that I heard from the Prophet, peace be upon him, when a man who was addicted to committing sins came to him and asked him, "Dear Prophet, if I were to remove one sin from my life, what would have the greatest impact? What would you want it to be?" And the Holy Prophet told him to let go of lying, and "I will check up on you every night. I will ask about your well-being every night. Just don't lie." The man went about his day thinking that this was a simple task, but when he wanted to steal, he stopped himself and asked himself, "Okay, what if at the end of the day, the Prophet asks me what you did today?" I couldn't lie to him, so he stopped himself from stealing. Later on, he wanted to commit another sin, and again, he asked himself this question. So again, this happened, and by the end of the day, he had committed no sins because of that one thing.
Because he could not lie to the Prophet.
Exactly, because he had to be truthful.
Yeah.
So maybe in being truthful, you have to change your lifestyle in a way to align with it. Therefore, you cannot commit a lot of the sins that you would normally do, maybe.
Mm-hmm. So you mean that truth, telling the truth, and to stop lying would help you be always on the right track of your journey in this world?
It could help a lot, at least.
Yeah. And you, Sister Nahid?
Yeah, referring to what our sister just mentioned, I'm going to talk about this very fact that maybe truth is not found in everything. It is the building block of everything. Imagine the fact that truth makes friendship, while lies break the relationships. And at the same time, our Prophet, even years before revelation, was called Muhammad al-Amin, the trustworthy, the one who wasn't supposed to tell lies, the one who was always doing the right things, and no one could have heard any lies from him.
Yeah, trustworthy
so,
he was.
Yeah, exactly. And that is why whenever we talk about truth, we may look at it as the building block of our life, mm-hmm. the thing that is going to be the basis for our true acts, for the things that we're going to make our lives based on.
Yeah, that's very true. Now that you are speaking of the building blocks and about the relationships, but haven't you ever been in a situation in which a truth is going to break the relationships and a lie would mend it all over again?
Yeah, it's natural. We all have had some situations like this, but I think if we're going to live truly and correctly in the best mm-hmm. way possible, we yeah. are even going to accept the fact. If there is a fact that may break my relationship with another person, so what's better than breaking it instead of telling some lies to ourselves? It's like fraud, you know?
I know what you say, but see, I don't want to break my relationship. I have done something wrong. I can't confess it. I can't say the truth. And if I say the truth, the relationship is going to be broken. So
what about telling the truth and finding some ways to make up for the
mess?
Oh,
now we have all been there, and there is no way to mend your face
it's
gone. So let's go for a break, and then we'll be back to hear some more. Truth self-sufficient in itself? Like, could we find everything in the truth? Well, the answer is so ambiguous. I know truth is the building block to everything, to every relationship, to whatever we do as human beings on earth. We are supposed to be truthful. But as human beings, as we all know, there are some times in our lives that we do wrong things and we cannot tell the truth about them. By the way, you're listening to Back to Reality. Sister Rehana and Sister Nahid are the very dear guests to this program, and we're talking about lying and truth. We always have these binary oppositions. When we have truth, we have lie. When we have lie, we have truth. When there is black, there is white. But isn't there any way for us to be gray?
Well, I personally think that being truthful doesn't necessarily mean telling all the truth all the time.
Ah, that's the point.
Yes. I remember a narration, if I'm not mistaken, from Imam Ali, peace be upon him. He was sitting somewhere in an alley, and a man ran past him. Mm-hmm. I think, if I'm not mistaken, he was holding a bloody knife. And Imam Ali, peace be upon him, stood up and sat somewhere else after the man was gone. And then a group of people followed after a while, and they asked him about it. Did you see a man run this way? And Imam Ali, peace be upon him, well, because he didn't know the situation, he didn't know if he was the victim or the perpetrator.
Yeah.
So because he didn't know the situation, he changed that position. And when they asked him about it, he said, ever since I sat here, I haven't seen anyone go by. So he was telling the truth. He had changed his seat after the man had passed.
But in a different way.
Yeah, so you don't tell the whole truth. If your wife, after giving birth, asks you, do I look fat? Do I look attractive now? You don't have to say that, no, you're ugly.
Yes.
Yes, you don't have to say the truth, mm-hmm. but you can say, wow, I love the glow that you have now.
Oh, that's very good.
Yes.
Changing the point of view, you mean, right?
Maybe, you don't have to always tell the truth if the truth hurts people.
Actually, what you were saying, the story you mentioned from Imam Ali, he was not actually lying. He was just looking at the truth from a different angle. Like, the thing that you're saying is that instead of saying the truth, which is going to be so hurting to many people, perhaps, we're just going to say another part of the truth, another dimension of the truth, in which we're not going to hurt anyone.
Yeah, and changing the point of view, judging the situation from both sides, mm-hmm. being the eyes of both people, and then not necessarily telling lies, but maybe not saying the truth completely. Mm-hmm.
And we also have recommendations in our religion, as just Sister Rehana mentioned. There is no need for you to say the whole truth all the time. Sometimes you can keep it for yourself, like as in relationship. Like in a life of a couple, you know something wrong about one of them, and then mentioning that to the other one is going to bring up a lot of issues. So why to bring all of those issues?
But still, I believe there should be some like limitations or some place around us. Like we need to know our limit. We need to know to what extent are we supposed to speak freely or not following the truth completely. Because this is very critical. Like, you know, some people just go with this saying that, have you heard some people are just saying white lies a lot and they regard them and they believe in the so-called white lies. What I believe in is that sometimes we need to know the limits. Mm-hmm. Like in my life, I am going to know my wife better if my wife is going to get sad. So it's okay for me to sometimes like hide the bitter side of the truth for her own well-being. But I still need to know the limits.
Yeah,
in some cases, she is allowed and she has all the right to hear the truth, even completely.
There are some borderlines we should not cross. And when we say, do not say the whole truth, we do not mean that forget about the truth and do whatever you wish for your own benefit.
Definitely.
No, it's not a mean to be used for your own benefit. It's just a way of helping other people not getting hurt. Like not lying, but not saying the whole truth either.
Yes.
So that's the thing we actually mean. By the way, I personally have an experience, a lot of experiences from telling the truth. That's why I've came to the conclusion that not all of the time you have to say the truth. Like we had a professor at university and then he asked us a question about, that was a relevant question at that time to our course. And then I said the truth. And then ever since I said the truth, I have been accused of being the girl who said that truth. So in the end, what I got was final score that was not my score was that comment score. You know what I mean? I mean, sometimes when you believe in the code that says honesty is the best policy, you're going to get hurt. So honesty is a good thing, but it has got some limits, I guess.
Yeah.
People are not going to tolerate all sorts of honesty.
The circumstance decides if we are going to tell the truth completely or not. Like sometimes in these situations, like the case you mentioned with your professor, I just try to keep the safe side and stay even silent, you know. Many times we cannot.
They insist. Yeah. I keep silent. I most of the time keep silent and try not to say that because I know the truth I'm going to mention is going to be bitter. But then they insist.
Yeah, exactly. That's my point. When we know the circumstance and the situation, we need to decide there. Like, am I going to tell the truth and face the results,
exactly,
which are mostly bitter, or not?
So I guess at this time we have to go for a change of mood and then come back.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
So this is the last part of today's episode in which we're talking about honesty. Well, honesty is so important in our religion. It's one of the fundamental issues that we have to consider it perfectly in our everyday life. If there's anything you want to add to the subject of honesty.
Yeah, the last point I want to mention is that looking at dunya, looking at this world, we can see the cases of our imams, our prophet, and too many people who were called by this name as sadiq people, as the people who were just telling the truth. And on the other hand, looking at the hereafter, looking at Quran texts and verses, we can see that in too many verses of Quran, even the world after is described, and we know how it's going to be, how beautiful the paradise will be for the truth tellers. Yeah, for the people who are just stopping themselves, preventing themselves from telling the lies. And in Surah Al-Maidah, for example, the rivers in the heaven and the paradise, they are all described and they are just called and devoted to the people who are following the truth and the way of truth.
Exactly. So, Sister Rehana?
I also think that it's very important to mention that our religion does not accept white lies.
Exactly.
So it's, you can not tell the whole truth, but there's no such thing as telling an outright lie for a good reason.
Exactly.
So that is it. So we must always tell the truth, but maybe not the whole truth.
Yeah, because they bring up this notion of you can be a bad person for a good reason. We don't have such a thing.
Yes, we don't.
Since we're considering different aspects of that issue, we can hide some part of the truth. We don't have to say it all with all the details. We don't have to do that. So I guess this was all. And by the way, truth is the thing that, as Sister Nahid mentioned, that builds our life. Like, if you do not build your life based on honesty, many problems could come to your life. Like, it's not one lie that you have to say. No, it's a succession of lies that you have to go through once you said only one of them. So why the problem? We can be honest and still have the benefits we're searching for. This was all. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. Until another session, I just bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi. Let the Ummah rise again.
Ya Allah,
Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi. Let the Ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again, once again.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters and all of our listeners. Welcome to the show, The Keys of Life, where we discuss the book Mafatihul Hayat, which means The Keys of Life, by Ayatollah Jawadi Amili, in which we discuss different techniques, different advices that the Prophet and the Ahlul Bayt have given us to make our lives better, to have a better life, as the name of the show is. And so far we've discussed many different topics. The topics, for example, that we discussed is how we should behave with believers, how we should be compassionate towards them, and there's been a lot of practical advice that has been provided. We've also discussed topics related to how we should be with those who transgress, those who are sinners, and how we should behave with them. Now finally, we come to a part of the book where the discussion takes on the hypocrites, the munafiqeen, as the word in Arabic is, and how we should be with those who hold this sort of hypocrisy within their hearts. Now, of course, we've been told to stay away from hypocrites, right? But sometimes it can be difficult for us to identify who is a hypocrite or not, because they're showing themselves as believers. When you speak to them, as the Quran says in Surah Munafiqun, when you speak to them, you might actually like what they have to say. However, in this book, through the sayings of the Ahlul Bayt, they have provided us with signs of how we can identify who a hypocrite may be. So some of the qualities of a hypocrite have been mentioned here. So I'll go through some of these qualities so that we all become familiar with those who are hypocrites. And also, if we have any hypocrisy within us, then we should try to remove it as well from within our hearts. So, of course, the first quality that's mentioned here is that they claim to have faith within them while these people are lying, right? Now, this may not always be easy to identify. However, as we go along and we look at the different qualities, we'll see how this actually plays out into a person's personality. When a person is lying about their faith, there'll be certain things which will come up which identify those traits within them. So, for example, one of the traits that's mentioned here is that these people are extremely afraid of death, and it's not the normal sort of fear of death that we're talking about here that many human beings may have. But for example, when they're called to, God says in the Holy Quran, you know, when they're called for jihad, for a holy war, then, you know, at that time, these people, they turn their backs. You know, they'll start making excuses. They will be afraid of going to war because they're afraid for their lives. So this is one of the signs of a hypocrite. Another sign is that they will find excuses, that they will, you know, they'll try to sort of shy away from the responsibilities when times are difficult. And God says, you know, these people, they might be trying to fool the rest of us, but they're not able to fool God himself. Now, in the world that we live in today, of course, this is an extremely important topic from maybe not only just from an individual point of view, but even from, let's say, a political point of view. You know, many times people are confused by the way certain countries behave, how certain politicians may behave, how certain groups among us may behave. And these traits that we're mentioning, they will help us identify when someone is being hypocritical or not. One of these traits which is related to this is that when someone is hypocritical or is a hypocrite, they want to cooperate with the enemy, right? They'll say things like, you know, we need to make peace with the enemy. We need to find ways to, like, you know, get along with our enemies. And all the time when they're calling for peace, the enemies, they're planning against them, right? They're planning against the believers. So one of the signs of the hypocrites that's mentioned here is that, you know, they want to cooperate. They want to work with the enemies of Islam. And one of the things that's mentioned here is that, you know, these people, they also start identifying people of different classes, right? For example, in the Holy Quran, you know, when it was said to some of these people, you know, you should come and believe, you know, become a believer, they would sometimes say, should we become believers like those that are poor among us, right? Should we become like them? So someone who's a hypocrite, you know, they will sometimes feel that they're better than, for example, someone who has less than them in society. And this is really talking about from an economical point of view. You know, the Quran says, is this how you're going to behave? That is this how you're going to identify faith is by, for example, somebody's economic or class level. So sometimes we see that among us, that there are people, they behave a certain way, for example, someone who's wealthy, and they'll behave a certain way with someone who's not as wealthy. And this is one of the signs of hypocrisy within someone. Someone who's a believer, they will behave, you know, in the same manner towards everyone, regardless of what their status level is in society. They will treat people not based on their, you know, how much money they have, but on more other real factors. So let's just go for a quick break, and then we will come back and speak about more of the qualities of a hypocrite.
Ayatollah Javadi Amoli, the author of the book Mafatih al-Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatih al-Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc.
One
But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree.
امام همونطوری که این رو گفته دارم گفته دی اون امامی که گفته اگر روزه بگیری ثواب داره همون امام گفته که اگر درخت بکاری اون ثواب داره.
Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
So welcome back, and we have been discussing the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life by Ayatollah Javadi Amini. And the topic we've been discussing today is related to hypocrisy, or munafiqun. You know, who are these people that are hypocrites and what are their traits? One of the traits that's mentioned here is laziness and or, you know, showing off when it comes to obedience or to worship to God. When someone has hypocrisy in them, they will be lazy when it comes to doing worship of God. Here it says, you know, that they don't actually really even believe in God. And so therefore, that causes laziness in them. And even when they do worship, it's only done to show other people. It's either to sort of appease other people, or it's to show off to other people, to show, oh, look, look at me, I'm worshiping, I'm praying, I'm spending the night, you know, doing all this worship. When in reality, this person doesn't really remember God. They're not really doing it for the sake of God. They're really only doing it for themselves and to show off. So this is something I think that we should all be careful of, that we don't become lazy when it comes to worship, that we don't, you know, do worship for the sake of showing off to others, which is a sin on its own, and it's also a sign of hypocrisy. Another sign mentioned here of hypocrisy is that a hypocrite makes fun of believers, right? They make fun of their beliefs, they make fun of maybe how they are behaving, and this is something that we should be really careful of and we should avoid doing as well. You know, Imam Ali alayhi salam, he said to his companion Kumail that keep away from hypocrites, don't go where they are, don't attend their gatherings, don't do business with them, try to stay away from them as much as possible, you know, don't listen to them, don't obey them. Thank you so much for listening. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of truth, hear the children's cries.
That was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time.
Covering Islam.
After birth, death is the greatest event in every person's life. It is the most private experience of every individual that cannot be shared with anyone else. Their death is followed by the destruction of the body as we know. However, would that mean the total destruction of the person? Why do we die at all? What is the philosophy of our temporary life on this earth? Why is death so scary for many people? Is the dichotomy of soul and body true? And if that is the case, what is the soul and how would it leave the body? If there is one thing that we can be certain of, it's that we will die. Yet, death remains one of the greatest mysteries that man has ever known.
There is a definition of death which doctors give us, which is when the brain waves or the electrical waves in the brain stop. That would be counted as death.
Scientifically, death is the cessation of all biological functions that maintain a person. Roughly 150,000 people die around the world each day, so it should be one of the most familiar subjects for all. Most people wish that they never have to think about it or face death, and they're even scared to think about it.
If you ask someone to enter a room and no one would be able to leave that room and come back and give you an experience of how it felt to go into that room, many people would hesitate to enter that room. In the same way, when it comes to death, many people who have died, and none of them have returned back to life to give us or share with us how they experienced that death, or where did they go? So it's a transition to, for us in this world, and for many, somewhere unknown.
The word death conjures up an idea of the end of things. When we use death in English, we say when something dies, it seems to us almost to mean that it is now useless. It can be discarded. It has no value. It has lost its vitality. But it's not a very good word, or it hasn't taken a very good meaning in that way, because in Islam, death is a transference, according to many hadiths, from one abode to another abode. It is like walking through a doorway. If you call a doorway death, fine. It certainly is not an end to life. It is a continuation to life.
You know, we can understand why people find it uncomfortable to talk about death. And one of the reasons is because of the intense love we have for the world. And death signifies a departure from these attractive, beautiful things of the world.
All cultures correspond death with frightening thoughts and images. The reason for that is because we look at it from the departure side, because we are scared to leave what we are very much familiar with to the unknown. However, if we were to see it as an arrival, we find it to be more of a blessing than a loss.
It's a shedding of clothes. It's taking, I don't know, you can say a shower and cleaning the filth from your body. So in other words, it's an existential thing. It's not absence of something. Unlike what we are brought up being taught, or directly or indirectly, about how death is absence of life. No, life, as we know it, is something that has different stages in Islam. So it's not that we have life and then death. Life continues. We just have to shift. We have to cross the bridge. Imam Hussein alayhi salam on Ashura, he would tell his companions that be patient. Death is nothing but a bridge where you're crossing to go to the better stuff, to higher levels of existence and life actually.
We are born for eternity, and death unfortunately is taken negatively as if it means the end. The Islamic explanation is that death is just a transfer. It's a gateway to enter the second, or the stage after this current stage. Stage one is this life. Stage two is transition between this life and the afterlife, the barzakh. Stage three, eternity.
What's important to realize is it's all like what we call the circle of life. There was the side of the human being descending from the higher up to dunya. And that's why dunya is called dunya, because it's at the bottom of the cycle. Okay. And then it will start to ascend back again to where it came from. And that's when the soul is separated from the body and the nafs goes back. Inna lillah wa inna ilayhi raji'un.
Yeah, Islam's picture of life and death is part of a broader process, part of a bigger process. It is simply a gateway into that which is to come.
Death is really the bridge that unites the lover with his beloved, meaning that, you know, a man who loved his Lord, he now wants to meet his beloved, his creator.
Man is a traveling creature. He starts from a drop, to clinging mass, to a fleshy tissue, to a fetus, to a baby, to a child, to a youth, to an adult, to an elderly, and eventually to the grave. But is the journey going to stop here? Is this the end? Or there are other stations to this uninterrupted journey?
We have a verse in the Quran, يَا أَيُّهَا الْإِنسَانِ إِنَّكَ كَادِحٌ إِلَىٰ رَبِّكَ كَدْحًا فَمُلَاقِيهِ. O man, you're moving towards your Lord, you're traversing a path towards your Lord, and you will eventually meet Him. This shows that we're on a journey, and life is a journey, and it ends with meeting our Lord. Does this journey end with death? The answer to this is that if we look at what the definition was in the beginning of life, then we will understand that life doesn't end with death. And since life doesn't end with death and is continuous, then so the journey continues as well.
The baby's journey to the world is full of wonders, and the elderly travels to the grave is even more wondrous. Now, based on Islamic teachings, death is ripeness of the soul and its readiness to be picked and initiated into the wonders of a new life. It is the tunnel to a phenomenal world of wonders.
The death, as we know it, is not an end to life. Rather, it is a portal, a doorway into a new and more expansive existence. And indeed, as we move on in this journey from this dunya into barzakh and then later on to the day of judgment, we are constantly evolving and changing. We're not dying.
But where is the destination of this journey? How many more stations are out there? Where is the map for this long travel?
We're here for eternity. We're born for eternity, not for death. Yes, since death is going to take us closer to that eternity, then in a sense you can say we're born to die. But not we're born to die in the sense that we are born for absence of life. No, we are born so that eventually we will be transmitted from one level of existence in life to the next level of existence in life to eventually attain that eternity we were born for.
Some say there is no afterlife, but they only assume. And why should we follow their assumption? Why should we think that this journey should stop so abruptly? Why should man, this traveling creature, stop traveling? If he were to stop, why did he set out? Why shouldn't we follow those who claim knowledge of that side and listen to those who only assume?
Somebody recently sent me a picture of twins in the womb of mother. One of them arguing that there is no life after birth, another saying there is life after birth. So in the similar way we are in this world, those who believe, they are arguing there is no life after this world, and others say there is life after this world.
I believe there is an afterlife, but I believe it cannot be objectively proven. It is something which you need to go inward through introspection, through interaction with Allah, and seeing the signs in your life. I believe the afterlife can be discerned from this life itself.
started from that drop of water, and we are where we are now. However, for the final destination, we need more progress. The Quran gives us some preview of what we may expect in our progress into future. We have to be prepared for that great encounter, meeting with the Lord, the Creator. He wants to share with us what he has. وَبَشِّرِ الْمُؤْمِنِينَ بِأَنَّ لَهُمْ مِنَ اللَّهِ فَضْلًا كَبِيرًا. He loves that you live beside him, pure and honest.